Music from the Chieftains to start us off on a Wednesday evening. Good Wednesday evening to you. My name is Carl Cumley. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Shoulta Gael. And our celebration of Celtic culture is taking a deep turn in the history of the American Southwest this evening. We have with us two good friends. One is a new friend. One is a friend of many years standing. The latter is Elena Claver, and the former is Dr. James Walsh from CU Denver, and he's with the history department there. And this evening, we're going to be talking about a remarkable piece of Irish history in the American Southwest. And welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good evening.
Great to be here. Whoops, let's go.
Thank
there
you. We go. There, got right. You up now. So the two of you, I know, have had a lot of commonality through the Romero Theater Group at CU Denver, and Dr. Walsh, you've been very much a part of that. Tell us a little bit about the Romero Theater Group.
Yeah, so we're about to celebrate our 15th anniversary. We were inspired to form, I guess, the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Oscar Romero in 2005. And we were invited to perform a play at Regis University about Romero. None of us knew much about him. And so in the context of putting the play together, we learned all about his life. And we were inspired by his story. The night of the performance, the MC stuck his head between the curtains before he introduced us and said, "Real quick, what do you call yourself?" I said, "The Romero Troupe." And so that's where the name came from. But we try to, the work that we do on stage, which is very non-traditional, we just try to follow in his legacy of speaking in solidarity with economically marginalized communities. And we've been trying to do that for 15 years.
And Elena, you are not only a federal court translator.
Interpreter, actually.
Interpreter, yes. I'm sorry. So, thank
okay.
you. And also very active in a number of social justice movements and split time between Colorado and Mexico as well. And what was your involvement? How did you come to be involved in the Romero Troupe?
Well, I'm kind of ancillary, I think, with the Romero Troupe. I kind of like I'm a sort of guest now and then. We cross paths in different events. I had known about Archbishop Romero from working with Solidarity with CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, and just trying to stop the U.S. intervention that was happening from the 80s, really, and so had done a lot of the music from there and things like that. And so when I first started hearing about the Romero Troupe, and, we would be at the same events together, so I feel like I'm not really a member. I don't go to the rehearsals or anything, but I try and, cross paths or go to the presentations when they have them and when I'm not performing, which is more of the times. But we had this very nice kind of wonderful coming together at this event, which I think I'll let James talk about because I just provided a song for it, but he and the troupe did all of the work for it.
Well, I'm interested because we're going to talk about the St. Patrick's Battalion during the Mexican-American War, and how did that come to be a focus for the troupe?
Yeah, I think I'll first say that Elena's story of how she became, sort of in partnership with the Romero Troupe, that is the Romero Troupe, in a nutshell, is just a network of people who come together from all walks of all different movements, different kinds of activism, and volunteer their time. And so in that regard, Elena is definitely a member of the Romero Troupe.
The T-shirt.
Yes. And it just is vast, loose network. And so we conceived this idea. Something I've been thinking about for years, but the troupe talked about it in the fall, of how can we contribute to the immigrant rights movement in a way that is not happening currently? a new strategy, a new idea. And we discussed the idea that what the identity of whiteness means in this country, and how that identity came to be socially constructed over the centuries. And someone was just giving voice to this idea of peeling the layers of that identity back in a way that reverses course. People are able to trace back into their own roots and develop a new sense of their own foundation, cultural foundation. And so it was the idea came that, hey, we should perform the little San Patricio story again. We haven't done it in years. And then I piped in because my idea was to have a solidarity night between the local Irish and Irish American community, which is a loose kind of community. You mentioned the Celtic Connection and this radio show, and there's lots of groups out there. But overall, that community has not been a voice in solidarity in today's immigrant rights movement. And the writer Helen Thorpe did a piece in the fall. BuzzFeed picked it up, and it was kind of a national story. And what she was doing is she was calling out people who identify as Irish American and saying, if you call yourself Irish American and your roots are the famine and your roots are, you know, the resistance against English imperialism, then if you know those roots, you must feel called to speak up today in what's happening on the border and what's happening with the separation of families. And the piece really had provoked a nice response, and it was part of the inspiration for this event. And so I have a lot of connections in the local Irish and Irish American community, so I started to reach out, and there was a very favorable reception to the idea. And I started to reach out to different segments of the immigrant rights community, and having it at El Centro Humanitario seemed like the perfect place. It's a day labor and cultural center, and it's been around for about 15 years. It's a place where immigrant workers find work, but they also find legal support, solidarity, and a variety of different capacities.
Is that the facility that's off of Park Avenue?
Yes.
In Denver?
That's it.
Yeah. I know it well. I'm down in that neighborhood a lot.
Yeah, it's surrounded now by these massive condominium complexes
huge.
That have just come
it's
in.
True.
So it's gentrifying. So they are moving because of that, because they want to be in a community that's predominantly immigrant, and that community is no longer. So anyway, things started falling into place. We decided to have music from both traditions, storytelling from both traditions, food. We nixed the Irish food, though. we decided that we could leave that piece out and not lose anything. But we had an amazing homemade tamales from members of El Centro, and it was a beautiful night. It was standing room only. We must have been a couple of hundred people there. Elena's music really brought a spirit to the space, and then we performed the story of the San Patricios, which is a story that almost no one knows.
Please dive right in. That's the focal point of what we want to talk about. And Elena, please let's make it a little bit of a colloquy, mm-hmm. but tell us about the San Patricios.
Well, I've been an historian now for 20 some years, and I have never once encountered a high school level history textbook that even makes mention of this story. It's a story that has been censored out of the narrative of American history. It's a story that even the overwhelmingly Irish Americans do not know. I had never heard of it.
In Mexico, it's certainly known, but not here.
Well, I would volunteer that the history of the Mexican-American War is not widely taught in secondary schools in the United States, and you have to do a little digging in university-level courses before you really get a picture of that war, which of course, resulted in so much of the Southwest United States coming under American control. as a war of conquest and manifest destiny. So I'm sorry I interrupted. So we
I welcome all of these interruptions because they're so useful and that's really true. And when the Mexican American War, as it's called, is taught, a version of it is taught that's very nationalist. It's often taught in a way that the Mexicans started it, and the fact that it was just a massive land grab is usually left out of the story. So anyway,
for people who may not be familiar with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and how much of the United States came in under American control as a result of that war, would you outline that for everybody?
Yeah. So the treaty that ended the war took about half of what was then Mexico, half of the country, what we consider today the entire Southwest, from California to Texas, was annexed into the United States. The treaty also guaranteed Spanish-speaking families who remained that they could keep their land. That promise was not kept. It was through legal fraud. Almost all of those land grants were seized.
Well, and the land grants themselves had to be approved by Congress in order to be valid.
Yeah. In the San Luis Valley, the struggle still continues around the Taylor land grant. And so when I was a graduate student, I started studying the Chicano movement because coming from Pennsylvania, I had never heard of it. It was fascinating to me. And I was meeting activists who had been active in the 60s and 70s. As I gained trust and built relationships with those activists, they would often sort of, it would be this ritual where they would learn that I was Irish, I had Irish roots. And they would sort of nudge me one day and say, "Hey, have you ever heard of the San Patricio?" and the first couple of times it happened, I would just sort of say, "No, who were they?" And then people start to explain it to me, and that's who I heard. That's who I learned it from—not from Irish or Irish Americans, but from Chicano activists. And I think that's important because that's a community of resistance that understands the importance of that story, and that's where that oral tradition is, where that story's held, and that's where that story's preserved. And so it's a story that's always meant a lot to me. And I was thrilled to perform it that night and to hear some of these songs. I'd never heard the song that Elena sang that night. I'm looking forward to hearing it again.
We will hear it tonight. give us the canvas of where Ireland is in the early 1840s, where the United States is, where Mexico is. We've come off. It's now 20 plus years since Mexican independence. Set the stage for us with these three countries that are going to come together in this story.
Yeah, so the canvas is very similar to people today coming to the U.S. from Central America and Mexico, fleeing violence and hunger. You had this event that is known as the potato famine, but the term that's used now more is the Great Hunger. It's about a 7-year event that led to the population of Ireland going from 8.5 million to about 5 million. As many as 1.5 million people died, and an equal number left, emigrated to the United States. And so these were not, voluntary immigrants showing up in the U.S. to seize the American dream. These were people who identified as exiles, not immigrants. They had been pushed out, shoved out. 20% died en route, thrown overboard, and were placed in quarantine when they arrived in Canada and the U.S. because many of them had what they called the fever, which were deadly diseases that took so many lives. So these were desperate, hungry, gaunt, starving, desperate, skillless people. And they were not received well at all in Canada or the U.S. They were looked at very suspiciously. Also, they were Catholic, which meant they were facing the kinds of anti-Catholicism that dominated the day. So many of those young men went straight into the military. And if you can imagine, because, of course, the Mexican-American War is happening simultaneously So if you can imagine these young men enduring that journey and then ending up with a gun in their hands in Tejas one day, just must have been bizarre. So some of the rituals the U.S. military practiced at the time were branding of soldiers caught being drunk, intoxicated, with a D branded on their cheek. And so these Irish soldiers were not treated well or faced discrimination within the military. And several hundred, I don't know the exact number, it's 300 or 400 maybe, made the decision to abandon the U.S. military and join the Mexican military.
This is when they've already left the East Coast. They're in Texas, down on the Rio Grande, and this is 1845-46?
A little bit later, maybe, 46, 47. and it didn't happen all at once. It was sort of happened in small groups of people abandoning. Of course, Mexico's trying to hold on to its northern territory.
Which had been confirmed by a treaty between Spain and the United States.
Right. Yeah, it was trying to entice people to settle there and to live there. Slavery was a big issue. A lot of the supporters of the war against Mexico were slave owners who wanted slavery expanded west. So this wasn't just about taking land, it was about expanding slavery. A lot of the northern politicians and Whigs did not support this war, including young Abraham Lincoln. And so, so that's what happened. These Irish immigrants then went to the Mexican side, joined the Mexican military, and reports began to trickle back to commanding officers of American soldiers encountering Irish in the battlefield. And it soon became apparent that this was a problem. This was an issue. So this story doesn't end well. Most of these San Patricios are captured and hanged as traitors. Some manage to just avoid being captured at all and live the rest of their lives in Mexico. There's lots of legend in Mexico about people who have Irish roots and red hair, and you hear this all the time. Wondering if they might have a San Patricio in their heritage. But the legacy of that moment, I think, in Mexico is really very important. And what we tried to do in the play and what we tried to do in that event is to carry that legacy forward and to challenge people who have Irish roots, and even those who don't, to say, where are my loyalties? You know, what when I witness what's happening, what is my responsibility? And there's different answers to that question, but
the legacy of that time too is very much in evidence across the American Southwest. One of the generals on the Union side later became president, but on the American side, Zachary Taylor, and there is a large mountain in northwest New Mexico, Mount Taylor, which is named after that participant in the battle. And so this is a story that lives on, and the story of, I think it's John Riley, who is a central figure. Tell us a little bit about him.
Not a lot's known about Riley. I think he came before the famine. He wasn't a famine refugee himself. I think he was in Canada for a while. But he became the leader of the San Patricios, someone who was respected, and he's the one who's remembered in the song. So, but there's not a whole lot of biographical information about him, and about any of them for that matter, because that's just the way it is with the famine. During the famine, there's not a lot of information about Irish immigrants who came here during that time period. So what we have left are just bits and pieces and scattered information and songs. Stories.
How about a song?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think Dave Rovics wrote this song, and I think it tells the story pretty well. And also, I should mention that Tim O'Brien wrote a really wonderful song. I believe it's called John O'Reilly. John Reilly. And I don't know that one, but you can look that up, too. But I think Dave Rovics really kind of nailed it with this, and I'll let you figure out the levels and stuff. My name is John Reilly. I'll have you here only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. And when I got to America, it was my duty to go. Enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. It was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. So in the midst of these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call.
Elena Claver, thank you very much. Terrific song. What do you take from that? What jumps out at you?
Well, for me, it's really the story about following your conscience and doing the right thing, even though it has very, very serious consequences. I mean, these were folks that were discriminated against, that were mistreated, that came from a history of colonization, of marginalization in their own country, and were exiled. I've heard it said, I don't know if this is true, but that the Great Famine was actually quite... There were a lot of human factors. It wasn't like just a natural disaster. It was kind of like so many other things that are called natural disasters, but in fact have very human roots as well.
Well, first there was the plantation of Ireland under Cromwell, and then a series of penal laws that limited the ability of families to alienate their own land, foreclosures and clearances, and then... Ultimately, when the blight hit the potatoes in 1845, there was just tremendous devastation, as James pointed out.
Yeah, so it's just really hard to imagine people who have lived and suffered through so much and then coming here and then being recruited, being often mistreated, and being sent to... what was Mexico then, and seeing, well, we're Catholics and they're Catholics, and, well, we've been displaced from our land, and here's, you know, and recognizing that commonality against the indoctrination of, you know, where they're, well, I don't think that they were getting paid, but, you know, wherever their food, their uniforms, whatever was coming from, and then just saying, we're going to do the right thing. And for me as an activist, I'm always kind of looking for how can we look for that opportunity to say, I'm going to step up and do the right thing. And how can we learn from those examples in the past? Because there are many examples, although quite often, as you've both pointed out, they've been hidden from us in the history books and the history classes. And here were people who, against all odds, did the right thing and suffered mightily for it. And yet in Mexico, they're fed it as heroes. And I think every year there's some kind of a celebration. And that kind of example of solidarity is, I think, what, James, what you were talking about is what needs to happen again in the fight for immigrant rights and for justice and human rights for all. So that's the inspiration that I draw from this history and from the music that comes out of it. And I think also you look at kind of the history of music in northern Mexico and how there was a real sort of cross-fertilization of things, and people got, you know, fiddle tunes and accordion pieces and things like that. And so the music was, of all of the peoples, the Irish people and the Mexican people, was very greatly enriched by that coming together.
So is it your thought that that there is a strain of traditional Irish music that turns up in what we'd know of mariachi and things like that in the north of Mexico?
Well, I'm not enough of a musicologist. I'm just kind of a musician, but I think there's quite a bit of that. And, you know, I mean, there's examples even from Europe of like the Celtos Cortos, those kind of groups from what's, I guess, Brittany and, you know, places in Spain and France and Galicia and, you know, where there is definitely Celtic music and it's being played and it's very much Celtic and there's bagpipes of different kinds that are played, gaitas, and, you know, different cultures have come up with that, and it's hard to say whether it's convergent evolution or if it's been cross-fertilized. I don't know, but...
One of the early Franciscan missionaries to New Mexico was a Father Morfi, M-O-R-F-I, in traditional Spanish rendering, and Father Morfi, of course, was a Father Murphy, who had joined the Franciscan order and come up into New Mexico through Spain. And in Ireland, there is Spanish Point, which is an area where a lot of sailors from the Spanish Armada ended up. There is a lot of that, as you say, cross-fertilization over the years.
Yeah, I think it's important to think about why they made this decision. And we talked about the mistreatment in the military, and one of the lines in the song is about American soldiers raping nuns. And I think that there was a shared Catholicism that was definitely central with the burning of churches. But there's another piece that some historians touch upon that I like to think was central, and that is the Irish had just left an anti-imperialist struggle. And suddenly here they were in this conflict where they were on the imperialist side. And that must have caused internal discomfort. So I think that had a big part to do with it as well. Tom Hayden wrote this book called Irish on the Inside, or Green on the Inside, I forget. And it's about how his roots are Irish, but he was raised not knowing anything about what that meant. And as he became an activist and grew older in his work, he began to believe that that inside of him was this spirit of resistance that he can only attribute to his Irish ancestors. And I think that's really why we tried to do this event and why this story needs to be told. When Helen Thorpe wrote that article, she kept seeing that these Irish names who were part of Trump's architects for creating his immigration policies. There's lots, indeed, in his cabinet. It's full of Irish Catholics. And so the question is, well, what happened? How did this happen? Everyone from Mike Pence to his former Homeland Security director, I think McAleen was his name. Today, Irish Americans are among the most comfortable, most educated people in the U.S. But just a century ago, Irish America was quite radical. And in terms of labor rights, in terms of events like the San Patricios, in Leadville, there were two massive strikes led by Irish immigrants that brought the Colorado economy to a standstill. And they had the martial law was declared both times to put down the strikes. There's the Molly Maguires, a secret society that existed in Ireland and in the U.S. that resisted cruel landlords. So that tradition is not more than a few generations in our past.
Well, even I'm one of the two items that I'd mention is before my time, but the other during my lifetime, Al Smith ran for president, and his Catholicism was asserted against him as a reason that he should not be elected president, that he'd be beholden to the Pope. And of course, in 1960, exactly the same charge was leveled against Jack Kennedy. So, you know, it really is within the last 60 years. Elena and I were talking about this before the show, that I think the mainstreaming of Irish culture into American culture really is a relatively recent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And seems to me that this is just my perception over the years, that it is something that we think less and less about, but it's something that was certainly very alive in some of the cultural awakening in the 1960s. I remember listening to Hootenanny records where they would play The Rising of the Moon, and the spoken intro to the song would be by a singer who, as a lead-in to the song, would say, the Irish fight for independence was a time when many people were imprisoned and music was banned, language was banned, culture, religion, all were banned. So it is something that is fresh in American history, and at the same time, as you pointed out, James, a lot of the United States Army before the Civil War and the fight against Native Americans on the Western Plains, there were many, many first-generation Irish that were in the van of those, the 7th Cavalry had first-generation Irish that were killed at the Greasy Grass Little Bighorn.
That's right. And as a part of that mainstreaming of Irish America came this great political transformation from radicalism to much more conservative bent, and that's really where Irish America is today. And there's a book called How the Irish Became White. It's quite influential in higher education, and it argues that in this country, Irish immigrants made this kind of Faustian bargain to WASP America, in exchange for helping to oppress communities of color, Chinese immigrants, African Americans, indigenous communities.
Italians, gangs of New York.
Yeah, Italians. The Irish were kind of ushered into the whiteness club. And so the book really, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the model, I still think it still holds water, even for those who disagree with parts of it. That huge transformation has taken place, and I've learned that in Ireland there's a term to describe politically conservative Irish Americans. They call them the alt Irish, and that's kind of a way to identify this new political animal in the Irish American community that is so much not only part of the mainstream but actually in many ways is the establishment today. And so this effort, this event we had, this one event, I guess the great hope is that it'll be like a snowball effect to begin to educate people who hold this identity and wear green on St. Patrick's Day, but have never imagined themselves stepping forward in solidarity against some of the racist and oppressive legislation and policies that are being enacted today, and the little conversations that we've had since the event have given us hope that it really did have an impact, and people want to do it again and have more and more of it. So, and then someone said, "Well, hey, my roots are Polish. I want to have an event with Polish Americans." So, who knows? Maybe there's a lot of hope in the strategy.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that maybe on St. Patrick's Day, instead of people just dressing in green or drinking green beer, they might actually celebrate the real history of resistance. You know, what really is embodied in all of that, and what the story of the St. Patricio Battalion has embodied.
Well, and I think there was a lyric in the song about it's half a century since Wolf Tone. And
yes.
The Wolf Tone Rebellion of 1798, as I recall, digging deep in for dates there. But, that history goes clear back, well, before Henry VIII, before Cromwell, before Henry VIII. I think it goes back to about 1100, which was when the Irish came initially under English control.
This was an example of music helping me learn history that I had never learned in any school. Because when I was singing the song, Wolf Tone, what's that? And so, of course, I went online to try and look it up. But I wonder if, Jim, you might talk a little bit about the project in Leadville and what the future might hold. Is that okay?
I would love to do that.
Oh,
let me take
music.
A really quick break to give some announcements to the community. And we will be right back with Elena Claver and Dr. James Walsh to talk more about Colorado history writ large, because there's a lot of San Patricio history and Colorado mining history, which is Irish history. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to KGNU.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac.
That old car been good to you? Now you can be good to it by donating it to KGNU. We'll use the vehicle to raise funds for the great programs you listen to and rely on. Put your unwanted vehicle into good hands by calling the vehicle donation line at 844-KGNU-CAR. That's 844-KGNU-CAR.
Scholte Gale is made possible by you, the KGNU listener member, and by the Celtic Connection. The Celtic Connection is a monthly newspaper for all people with an interest in Celtic news, music, language, culture, and tradition. For subscription information, visit CelticConnection.com or call 303-777-0502.
Support comes from Z2 Entertainment presenting Electric Hot Tuna plus the David Bromberg Quintet at the Boulder Theater on Friday, February 28th and Saturday, February 29th. Ticket information available at bouldertheater.com.
Support comes from Z2 Entertainment presenting The High Kings at the Boulder Theater on February 16th. Ticket information available at bouldertheater.com.
We are back with Elena Claver and Dr. James Walsh from CU Denver and the history department there to talk about Irish history in Colorado and particularly the San Patricios during the Mexican-American War and also in the mines of Colorado up in Leadville. So tell us what's going on up in Leadville.
Yeah, so... Leadville is a very important place in Irish American history. There were as many as 3,000 Irish-born immigrants that lived in Leadville in 1880. It was an enormous, enormous ethnic community. Figures like Oscar Wilde visited Leadville. Michael Davitt, who started the Irish Land League, he visited Leadville twice. So Leadville was a very important Irish place. And it was also the heart and soul of the Colorado economy, the silver mines. So these Irish immigrants in Leadville were at the bottom rung on the social ladder. And they didn't just accept the conditions that they worked in and the situation that they're in. They launched and led two massive miner strikes. One was in 1880 and one was in 1896. 5,000 miners walked out of the mines in 1880, paraded through Leadville, declaring that they weren't going to accept the $3 a day wage, the unsafe conditions, and they brought the silver mines to a standstill and really the Colorado economy to a standstill. The governor responded by declaring that the media declared the Molly Maguires have taken control of Colorado. That was the Rocky Mountain News and Denver Post, and declared martial law and sent the Colorado National Guard to Leadville to crush the strike. So the soldiers arrested striking miners and made them work on chain gangs, building roads. So the strike was militarily crushed, and they struck again 16 years later, and that strike had a very similar ending, although it lasted much longer. That strike lasted 10 months. And a splinter group of the Irish tried to take back some of the mines in the middle of the night that had been open with scab labor. They called themselves the Regulators, and they armed themselves, and they attacked the Robert Emmett Mine, which is ironic.
Robert Emmett Mine.
Robert
Emmett was one of the great patriot martyrs of Irish history.
Yeah, the O'Donovan Rossa Mine, the Robert Emmett Mine, there's the Wolftone Mine in Leadville. I mean, the city has such an Irish flavor. So they built a homemade cannon that shot chains, and they attacked these two mines in September of 1896. The attack was repelled because they had infiltrated the Union. They knew the attacks were coming. But this is an example of the radicalism of 19th century Irish immigrants and how they really faced this economic industrial complex that they were victim to in many ways. And so in the back of the cemetery, the Evergreen Cemetery in Leadville, there is an unmarked section, a pauper section. And the water's not watered. I'm sorry, the grass is not watered. It's not cared for. It's just unmarked sunken graves, about 1,500 of them. And that's just the Catholic section.
Wow.
So I didn't discover this. It's been known. But I came across it in my research, and I was deeply moved by it. You cannot walk through this and not be moved by it. Many of the graves are 2 feet long, infants and children. And I've never forgotten it. And so a few years ago, we reached out to the Irish government to let them know about this, is thinking that they would be interested. We found in the records that maybe about 70% of the names of those buried there are Irish names. So the Irish government was immediately interested. They sent the consular general here from Austin, Texas. We took him up there. He encouraged us to apply for a grant to put a memorial. We won that grant. And in May, the Irish ambassador to the U.S. came to Leadville. We took him to the cemetery and walked he and his wife through. And that really had a big impact. So we've raised a good chunk of money for this memorial. It's going to start in May, and it's going to include all the names, not just the Irish names, by the way. We definitely did not want to leave any names out, whether they're Irish or non-Irish. And the memorial will start in May and possibly be complete and ready by the time the snow falls in the next winter. But I just want to say that what we discovered, the average age of the people buried there is 21.
Wow.
And that one number says so much. 48% are 12 or younger. Up to, I think it's 10% are listed as stillborn. So the number of children, almost half of all the graves are children. So that really impacted me and impacted everyone involved. We sort of carry this sense of the history of the famine, but we don't realize that this tragedy occurred here in North America too, because these were the most desperate workers in the mines, in the mills, digging the canals. They died very young. So the memorial, is coming into this year. We still don't quite know the design. It's not been finalized. There's going to be a statue in the center, and we're still discussing what that statue should look like. Like a strong representation of a strong, hardy miner. But my idea is that the statue should represent the struggle and the suffering that people endured there. It shouldn't be just a hardy miner. So anyway, that those decisions are being made as we speak. But we're going to have a big unveiling in the fall, and I hope that unveiling is not just the Irish community, but I would like members of the 21st century immigrant communities to be there, indigenous communities to give us permission, the Ute Nation. So who knows how big this will be, but pay attention to it, and we'll hope to post something along the way so people can know, to go up there sometime in September or October.
The next time I am in Leadville, I have a new destination, and I perambulate across the Southwest all the time. We've got the bicentennial of the Santa Fe Trail coming up in 2021, and of course, the Santa Fe Trail was how Stephen Watts Kearney and the Missouri Volunteers marched from Missouri to Las Vegas, New Mexico, over Raton Pass, and announced the annexation of New Mexico in the plaza, the old plaza in Las Vegas, and then pressed on to Santa Fe through the pass there at I'm spacing the name of the battle,
Glorieta Pass.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And again proclaimed the annexation in Santa Fe. And so very much this it is Colorado and Southwest history, very much.
It is. I just wanted to make quick mention too of this Irishman who led that first strike in 1880. He was Dublin born. Name was Michael Mooney, and I became so enthralled with him because he was a great leader. He kept the men peaceful throughout that first strike, and according to the news accounts, sober. So I started. I went out and I bought a costume, 19th century miner costume, and I dress up as him and go to schools and businesses and do a monologue, asking for help. The strikers need help. We need your support. I followed him. He was blacklisted after the strike because he was a leader, couldn't get work, so he stayed in Leadville, but he drifted all over the American West mining and ended up in L.A. and had 7 kids. I became kind of obsessed with him. To me, he embodied what we're talking about tonight, this whole idea of Irish-American radicalism. He embodied it in the most positive of ways. So I went to LA and I found his grave, and that was just like a pilgrimage to me. And then I decided I needed to find his descendants because I wanted to know if they knew what he had done. And I suspected they did not, to get back to our earlier point about Irish Americans forgetting their history. So a genealogist heard me give a talk, and I said, I want to find his descendants. One day I'll find them. And she came up to me and she said, Diana Copsey, wherever you are, thank you. She said, I'm retired. I have a lot of time. She said, I'll find them. So she emailed me 2 days later with the name of his only living grandchild, Marilyn Mooney, 91 years old. And I called her, and I'm still in touch with her. And she and her family knew nothing.
Oh, really?
All they knew is he was a miner. That's it. That's where it ended. And I just dumped, I sent them the book. I dumped all of the information on them, and it was kind of a shocking thing for them. Her sons are, I forget, like investment bankers in London or something, and they're trying to understand what this means. And that story to me is so indicative of people in this country with Irish roots who have no idea, to get back to Tom Hayden's book, too, just no idea that they're green on the inside. So I just wanted to share the Mooney. So Mooney will somehow be, I want his name somehow on that memorial, if it's possible.
Under the leadership of Mooney.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I was thinking about the change, the sea change that seems to happen in the latter 20th century about Irish assimilation. And the picture that comes to mind is a picture of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. And that to me encapsulates, you know, the old ward healer politician that's Tip, who took over JFK's congressional seat, rises to the speakership of the House of Representatives, and on the other side of the table, Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy right there.
Yeah, and that old school Irish Catholic Democrat has kind of a dinosaur. It's sort of falling by the wayside. The Teddy Kennedy, Joe Biden.
Although you had Dennis Gallagher come to the event, which was most wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, Dennis is kind of the last of that, you know, of that era. And I think when AOC won her congressional seat, the Democrat she bumped out was of that old Democrat, Irish Catholic political machine in New York. Yeah. And it was so indicative of a kind of a changing of the guard. And that's a good thing, because that needs to change. Yeah.
I do want to wrap up here. Elena went into the library and pulled out a song by Tim O'Brien about John Riley. It's a 5-minute long song, and so that'll get us up to the top of the hour. But James Walsh from the History Department at CU Denver, Elena Claver, with your music and your activism, thank you both so much for coming together tonight to really do some phenomenal teaching. I'm much richer for it, and I hope our listeners are too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's go out with music from Tim O'Brien and John Riley. You're listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins.
John Riley came from Galway town in the years of the Irish hunger, and he sailed away to America when the country was much younger. Now the place was strange and work was scarce, and all they knew was farming. So he followed his other Irish friends to a job in the U.S. Army. Adventure calls and some men run, and this is their sad story. How some get drunk on demon rum and some get drunk on glory. Now Now they march down Texas way to the banks of the Rio Grande. They built a fort on the banks above to taunt old Santa Ana. They were treated bad and paid worse, and then the fighting started. And the more they fought, the less they thought of the damned old U.S. Army. Adventure calls and some men run, and this is a sad story. How some get drunk on demon rum and some get drunk on glory. Church bells rang on a Sunday morn that set his soul to shiver. He saw the senoritas washing their hair on the far side of the river. Then John Riley and 200 more Irish mercenaries, they cast a lot, right or not, south of the Rio Grande. Adventure calls and some men run, and this is a sad story. Ah, some get drunk on demon rum and some get drunk on glory. Fought bravely under the flag of the San Patricios, till the Yankee soldiers beat them down at the Battle of Churubusco. Then 15 men were whipped like mules on the cheeks, they were hot iron branded, made to dig the graves of 50 more who were hanging faded handed. Adventure calls and some men run, and this is a sad story. Some get drunk on demon rum, and some get drunk on glory. John Riley stands and he drinks alone at a bar in Veracruz, and he wonders if it matters much if you win or if you lose. Well, I'm a man who can't go home, I'm a vagabond, says he. I'm a victim of some wanderlust and divided loyalty. Adventure calls and some men run, and this is a sad story. Some get drunk on demon rum, and some get drunk on glory. Adventure calls, and some men run, and this is a sad story. Some get drunk on demon rum, and some get drunk on glory.
Music from Tim O'Brien, a song about John Riley. Once again, our great thanks to Elena Claver and to Dr. James Walsh for joining us tonight to talk about Los San Patricios. And if you go online, there is plenty to learn there, including a couple of pretty good documentaries as well. So lots of studying and lots of understanding of our history here in Colorado as well. We've got Musica Mundi coming up for you next. We're going to throw it over to our overnight program and just remind you that you're listening to KGNU 88.5 FM, 1390 AM, Boulder, Denver, 98.7 FM in Fort Collins, 93.7 FM in Nederland, Colorado, and online around the world at kgnu.org. and afterfm.com.
Pede música, melhor ficar na música. Porque mulher de música é coisa de utilidade pública. Mulher de música, melhor ficar na música. Porque mulher de música é coisa de utilidade pública.
E além disso, sim, a de iaia. Musa é musa e mulher de carne e osso. Vem a ser hipotenusa que me usa parafuso. Me recusa e ainda me acusa.
Marina, assim toda pintada, parece um pincel. Doralizou o cabelo, agora quero usar chapéu. A Isabel me acusa de abusar da regra 3. Enquanto isso, a Marieta só me diz talvez. Pra aquela selva dei o céu, comida e aluguel. Na mão da Vera já virei bolinha de papel.
Mulher de música, melhor ficar na música. Porque mulher de música é coisa de utilidade pública. Mulher de música, melhor ficar na música. Porque mulher de música é coisa de utilidade pública.
E além disso, sim, a de iaia. Musa é musa e mulher de carne e osso. Vem a ser hipotenusa que me usa, parafusa. Me recusa, ainda me acusa.
Kasi, kasi mani de.